And that is the kicky music that means it's time once again for Pop Culture Happy Hour. I'm Linda Holmes. I'm the editor of NPR's pop culture and entertainment blog, Monkey See. And I'm here around the table with the Pop Culture Happy Hour crew, Glenn Weldon. Tell the nice people what you do at NPR.
I write about books and comic books for the NPR website.
And Trey Graham, what do you do at NPR?
I read Glenn Weldon and laugh hysterically, and occasionally I edit movies coverage for NPR.org.
Those two things are not related.
And Stephen Thompson, what do you do at NPR?
I am an editor at NPR Music.
You know, this episode, if all goes according to plan, will be made available to people on April 1st. So we thought we would have a brief discussion of April Fool's Day, pro and con, and I am anxious to see whether we can wrestle up a pro.
Well, I think it's worth noting that there is a venerable tradition of All Things Considered stories that are April Fool's themed, and people do their best to make them seem plausible for at least a minute.
Right. Mm-hmm. Absolutely. So. But I know, Stephen, in general, you have expressed some lack of fondness.
I feel like I am too April Fool's Day as Glenn Weldon is to love.
As Glenn is to faith, hope, and charity.
All right. Moving on.
For whatever reason, the event, the day, I just have no sense of generosity about it at all. It just brings out this giant surge of hacky comedy. And
that is like love, you have to admit.
It is a little bit. It is a little bit like love in that way. And part of it is just my own personal biases and experiences of April Fool's Day is tomorrow. Can you help come up with the wacky thing? Oof, boy.
I will say, I like a good prank as much as the next person. And when I thought about this today, I was thinking when my mother used to be the principal of a high school in Minnesota, they had a senior prank. And I don't necessarily think it was April Fool's Day, but it was their senior prank. The kids put an ad for the school in the real estate section.
They had people calling to buy it.
So, of course, the description was like 18 bathrooms, you know, yeah. Tennis court.
That's pretty good.
And the best part, big yard for kids, dog. Mm-hmm. And they had the number of my mom's office at school as the number in the ad. And everybody thought it was very, very funny. It was not problematic. It was witty. It was, you know, like actual witty pranks are fine. The problem to me is like the thing that gets posted that's just kind of like, Lindsay Lohan is buying Microsoft.
Right.
Sure. Well, I suspect that Stephen's true objection to April Fool's Day is that April Fool's Day, like love, is about having the rug pulled out from under you at the last possible moment and being made to feel like a gigantic moron, right?
But how often do they work on you? They never work.
I think part of it is, I mean, we can say of all sorts of things, you know, that sort of 90% of anything is crap and hacky garbage. You just have to find the right 10%. Mm-hmm. And obviously a well-executed April Fool's Day joke and a well-executed April Fool's Day prank is really funny and great. But for some reason, just telegraphing it by having a day for it. Just
you know what I'm hearing, Stephen? I'm hearing sour grapes. I'm hearing jealousy.
Fair.
Because you couldn't fool your own mother on the foolingest day of the year with an electrified fooling machine. This is, in many ways, my day. This is the one day a year when my pathological inability to trust others is entirely vindicated. This is the day for surly skeptics.
You are untouchable on April Fool's Day because you never believe anything we're telling you anyway.
Absolutely. This is my point. Certainly, pranks I don't dig, and anything that anybody kind of comes up to you as a person on April Fool's Day and then ends with April Fool's, that is, odious.
And I think that's how I view it, and maybe that's what I'm objecting to.
You should absolutely be allowed to carry a super soaker for those occasions.
Sure. I approach that day, though, as like, you know, bring it, Internet. Let's see what you got. You just sit there and you kind of gird your loins and you kind of wait for it. And yes, a lot of the stuff is sort of twee and sort of, you know, it's tittering to itself even as it says it. But there was a really great comics-related one a few years back. Mark Miller, comic book writer. It wasn't technically an April Fool's thing because he knew people would get it if he did it around April Fool's, so he did it in September. But he basically wrote a column for a website he was working for at the time, Comic Book Resources, that basically said, as many comic historians know, in 1946, a young Orson Welles was looking for an ex-project, and he was a fan of this new superhero called Batman, just as he was a fan of The Shadow, and he voiced The Shadow several times. He was looking to make a movie project of it, and he approached James Cagney to be the Riddler and Basil Rathbone to be the Joker, and Miller came up with some drawings of, you know, Orson Welles' sketches of the Bat costume, and the tone was perfect, because the tone wasn't, I just dug this up, and I have found this. The tone was,
breaking!
Yeah, as many people know.
Sure.
And there is such a fear of not being in the know in the comics community. That everybody's like, yeah, that's great. No, I knew about that. That was great. And I went on for a little. But the other thing is, I wanted it to be true so much. That's the other key. Mm, I mean, it's Lindsay Lohan, blah, blah, blah. You got to find something that would be like, oh, that would be awesome. Well, and it would be awesome for
Orson Welles. If it functions as sort of science fiction, you know, what if, blah, 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 that's fine.
This is key to a thing that I noticed recently that was not exactly an April Fool's joke, but I have to confess that I really, really wanted this thing to be a real thing.
Was it the pet petter?
Yes, that's right.
The pet petter made me so very happy.
Call back.
I really wanted that to be a real thing.
This is in some ways related. This is the petite lap giraffe. Did you guys see this thing?
Is that a euphemism?
That sounds like a sad, sad euphemism.
No, this is a thing that was on the internet recently. It is
not
at all dirty. There's a series of DirecTV commercials where there's this Russian billionaire who's talking about how he's got to have the best of everything, but he's just as glad to get a good deal on DirecTV. And off in the margins of the scene, in one of the commercials, there's this tiny little giraffe running on a treadmill, like it's getting its exercise. In another one of the things, the camera sort of pulls back from the guy, and you see the tiny little giraffe sort of curl up on the sofa next to him.
And your thought was, I wonder if that's real?
And then, no, my thought was not, I wonder if this is real, because I had not actually seen the commercials at all. But it turns out the marketing agency behind this campaign, being all social media savvy and whatnot, set up a fake website for a farm in Russia that was supposedly breeding these things. And if my Twitter feed is any indication, there were a surprising number of people who were not immediately sure that this was a gigantic peck of foolishness. Mm-hmm. Though, you know, if farm in Russia breeding tiny lap giraffes is not enough to sort of send a flag up for you, I don't know what is. But some friends and I were talking about their pressing need for a teacup pot-bellied pig last night, and I showed them the website, and we agreed immediately that science should get on the petite lap giraffe thing right
away.
There you go.
So we like a good prank. We like a good hoax.
Bah humbug, man. I just don't know. It's the day of the year that I most want to take off work.
Well, perfect. Glad to know that.
At NPR, there's people coming up to you going like, pull my finger, or whatever.
There was a April Fool's music story within the last couple of years, right, about a minimalist composer who wrote entirely in the note B, or something like that.
The Cajun triangle. Yeah. That was one.
This is Stephen's equivalent of reporting on horrible, horrible world events. Is when he has to write a fake story about a guy playing the triangle. At any rate, if you out there have your favorite April Fool's story, or if you have an opinion about April Fool's Day, or if you want to say something to us and then at the end say, just kidding, you can find us on Facebook by searching for Pop Culture Happy Hour, or you can do so at the blog at Monkey C. And we always forget to mention this, but you can find all the podcasts at npr.org/PCHH. So the next thing we thought we would talk about today is inspired, we admit, by the Manic Pixie Dream Girl, which is the wonderful, wonderful, and oh so very useful and so badly needed description/archetype invented by Nathan Rabin at the AV Club. Now, this is not our effort to actually force anything into the canon. Please don't think we're trying to out Nathan.
Good Lord. It cannot
be. Because it would not be possible. I think it will be 20 years before anything is this much of a, oh, we needed that so very bad. Mm-hmm. But we did think that we would take a shot at trying to name some upcoming / badly needed archetypes to explain fundamentally how fiction and movies work.
Should we give a quick background about the Manic Pixie Dream Girl for those who aren't familiar with
her? The Manic Pixie Dream Girl, in case you are not familiar with her, is the, I think of the classic as being Natalie Portman's character in Garden State. Mm-hmm. It's the sort of young, cute, weird...
Free spirit.
I think of Sandra Bullock... in the Ben Affleck...
Forces of Nature. Yep. And there's one called Autumn in New York, where Winona Ryder is a whimsical dying hat designer.
There you go. Yes. That's the trifecta right there.
Yeah. And the movie in which I believe the description originated was Elizabethtown, which has Kirsten Dunst, is the Manic Pixie Dream Girl. And once you start looking for them, you see them everywhere.
You see them everywhere, yeah.
And in fact, you can see them throughout history as it has been suggested, that there are sort of classic female characters, including Katharine Hepburn in Bringing Up Baby.
Mm. Holly Golightly.
Holly Golightly, who have elements of this, but it became something that really has been massively fixated on in the last perhaps 10 years of young, schlubby writers get all the cute chicks movies.
You're jumping on my...
I am going to go to Stephen first, because apparently his is related. So why don't you explain?
You stepped on my archetype. Mine is nebbishy, aspiring screenwriter who gets laid all the time.
I see.
I did step on her. Stephen and I occasionally share a brain, much to our detriment.
The most disproportionately oversexed stock character in all of cinema is the aspiring screenwriter who has to choose between the hot actress and the supermodel, where, like, Paul Giamatti has to choose between Mila Kunis and Elle McPherson. And, you know, Elle McPherson, she's a little older.
Right.
You know, she's maybe a...
So that would be the soulful choice.
Those are the two Hollywood types who are competing for his attention. There's the third plain girlfriend who's played by somebody like, you know, Laura Linney, because she's...
Right. Right, some withered old crow, right? Like Laura Linney. I think ultimately it's Woody Allen's fault. Every Woody Allen movie is him like, well, I'm sleeping with Mira Sorvino. This is not my Woody Allen impersonation, but it's like, oh, I'm sleeping with Mira Sorvino, but, you know, here's Scarlett Johansson over here. I don't know what to do. And I do think part of it is Woody Allen's fault. Part of it is the fault of the diseased petri dish that is LA, where I think those guys actually do have choices like that if they have ever successfully gotten a movie made. Mm-hmm. But as a moviegoer, it is just this bizarre and sort of Eric Schaefer. Do you know that guy?
Oh, yes.
That filmmaker? Eric Schaefer.
He made the movie If Lucy Fell, and he also makes some really hateful television. It's a long story, but he is a really, yes, Eric Schaefer.
A really regrettable person, I think is the word I'm looking for. The guy from Scrubs.
Zach Braff. I was waiting for you to talk about that one.
To launch into my bitter anti-Zach Braff screed.
About the poster.
He looks as if he has just witnessed, like, war atrocities.
Yeah.
And he's sitting there just, like, staring off into the middle distance. And there's, like, one...
Rachel Bilson. Rachel Bilson is on one side. Do you remember who's on the other side?
I do not.
Jacinda Barrett, who was on the London season of
The Real World.
Wow.
And is sort of a real world participant, but a very pretty girl. And so it's Rachel Bilson and Jacinda Barrett.
And he's just tortured. He's tortured. What's he going to do? He's just got so much love to give, but he can only give it to one beautiful woman.
This was described when it happened on Friends. It was described as my wallet's too small for my 50s and my diamond shoes are too tight. Which is really something which is useful.
Just the mournful movies in which schlubby dudes
who are always screenwriters, because I wonder how that happened.
and Forgetting Sarah Marshall,
change that to the composer and you got Forgetting Sarah Marshall.
Right, it's that same thing where it's like he's a plucky young schlub with a dream. You know, who's he gonna
he
wants to write a musical about vampires, and here's Kristen Bell and here's Mila Kunis.
Relatable.
How will he solve this terrible problem?
It's like they never got that note. Make him relatable.
Yeah. I like it.
So nebbishy aspiring screenwriter guy.
Excellent job. Trey Graham.
I was for a time paralyzed by coming up with something because, you know, you cite the example of Manic Pixie Dream Girl, and I, of course, feel the need to come up with something better.
Right.
So I sat there spinning my wheels for a time, but I think I've got something. So you tell me what you think. The laconic editor who, unlike Helen Mirren's character in State of Play, doesn't cuss much but instead puts his head down and quietly gets the work done while insisting on core journalistic principles in an unshowy, mild-mannered way, because I'd watch that guy.
So you haven't so much seen that as
you were trying to get that off the ground, are
yes.
you?
Yes, yep. Good now, for
if
you.
That, if that doesn't work for you, how about the billionaire who has a distinct and easily caricatured physical trait, for instance, large, goofy ears or bizarre hair, and who, despite indications that it's a thankless job, persists in his efforts to buy the presidency?
Nice. There you go.
These are like skeletons with top hats and monocles.
What I like about this is Trey is writing his own ticket. Like, Trey doesn't feel reined in by actual movies.
Sure. Right.
Trey isn't like, boy, I hate it when movies do this.
Right.
I got one more. Misunderstood developing nation potentate who seems to be the villain, but who really has everyone's best interests at heart. You may think that I am kidding with this, but Even Money says Adam Sandler will one day make that movie.
There you go.
I haven't seen that much wish fulfillment since the last schlubby screenwriter wrote himself into a love triangle with Kristen Bell and Mila Kunis. Yep. Anyway, Glenn Weldon.
I got the wish fulfillment thing covered because I also had trouble coming up with something. So what I decided to try to do is to try to tweak an existing archetype to make it something that I could relate to. And this is, I call this nerd with a lowercase n. It seems recently that films and television have been kind of conflating your garden variety North American nerd with comic book guy. If a guy's a little bit nerdy, he is the weird, extreme, cartoonish, literally cartoonish example of the form. So my point is, you know, Hollywood, pick one. So if we meet a nerd in your movie, we know that by the third act, he is going to be hacking into the CIA mainframe with his MacBook Pro. That's fine. But pick one. If he's doing that, he doesn't need to have a Xena t-shirt. Mm-hmm. He doesn't need to live at home with his mom.
There doesn't need to be a scene at a con.
There doesn't need to be a scene with a con. He doesn't need also to have Funyun breath and Cheetos fingers. And he doesn't also need to be played by Justin Long. Just throwing that out there. Pick one.
Until you got to the Justin Long part, I sat there thinking, am I a nerd? I have Cheeto fingers.
And Funyun breath.
One more, real quick, because I want to see my people represented on screen. I want to see one movie.
The Welsh.
Yes, I've seen.
The pale and Welsh creatures.
No. A gay best friend who is no help at all during the shopping montage. I want to see the girl step out of the dressing room, step in front of the three-way mirror, spin, and then go, huh?
And have the guy be like, ah.
Cut to the dude going, I don't even... Is that blue? What color is that?
I don't know.
That's what I want.
I definitely think that a different kind of gay best friend is a great idea.
Definitely. Yes. Overdue.
Yes.
Because,
overdue.
You know, a lot of women do have the gay best friend, but a lot of the gay best friends are like, that guy can't dance his way off of a paper bag.
Sometimes the gay best friend is colorblind.
True. Exactly. Thank you, Trey.
I would not go to most of my gay best friends for decorating advice. No offense.
I don't know. I've been to Glenn's apartment, and I didn't think I would be going to Glenn for decorating advice. Glenn.
Oh, that's the gay best friend's husband.
That's the gay best friend. It has nothing to do with the game. And also, let's not have him played by Stanley Tucci. Pick one role, Stanley. Let it pass.
Pick some other gays, people.
I love it. Very good. All right. Well, mine, I more went the Steven route of trying to identify.
Come up with something based on actual evidence?
Of trying to come up with something that actually exists. I think both are valid. I considered going with the Apatovian man-child, or the schlubby, recession-afflicted wanderer, laid off from his job,
whatever.
Also frequently played by Paul Giamatti. Right.
Paul Giamatti in general is an archetype.
I ultimately went with a fellow I'm going to call Sir Deadheart the Stoic.
Okay.
Okay. Whose superpower is taking his terrible, tragic losses and channeling them into mind-blowing sex. I'm just going to say. Okay?
I haven't seen that movie.
No. Glenn's like, where do I find this?
Exactly.
Is he played by one of the Wilson brothers?
No. Okay. Older.
Oh.
Sir Deadheart the Stoic. Think Kevin Costner.
Okay.
Kevin Costner in, like, have you ever seen Message in a Bottle?
No.
Okay. Kevin Costner in Message in a Bottle is this tragic figure, and he's lost
his wife. Oh, wait, I have seen that movie.
And he's lost his wife, and he's just very, very terribly sad. And Clint Eastwood has played a certain number of these guys.
Jeff Bridges, or is he too classy?
Jeff Bridges can definitely play this kind of guy, although he tends to do more interesting things. Robert Redford in The Horse Whisperer. Sir Deadheart the Stoic. Something terrible has happened to him.
I would like to posit that the female equivalent of Sir Deadheart the Stoic is always played by Catherine Keener.
Yes.
Okay.
I can see that. I can go for that. Although a lot
who
of
I love,
times,
I should just go
more,
on the record
she's a
and I love
more
her.
Rye.
She's a little more warm and rye. These guys are a little bit more Bridges of Madison Countonian.
Sure, that's the example that was jumping into my head.
Yeah. Oh, Richard Gere also in that one with Winona Ryder where she makes hats. it's very much that, and he spends a lot of time in one of two places. One is the ocean, or by the sea. Mm-hmm. It can be on the sea or by the sea. The other one is in finance. Because he's typically either thrown himself into banking or thrown himself...
Jack Nicholson has jumped into this role in recent years.
A few times, yeah. And so he's either thrown himself into banking or he's thrown himself into sextants. You know what I mean? Like ships in bottles and
ships in bottles.
Navigating by the sun.
Standing
the
on stars. Rocky crags.
So that's mine, is Sir Deadheart the Stoic. And the next time you see him, you will recognize him.
Yes, good.
Absolutely.
So, next up, we want to take a shot at something that we've talked about sometimes on this podcast, which is the idea of genre. Now, I recall the drinking game in which every time I said genre, people had to drink. So I'm not going to say it anymore. Genre, just kidding. but we thought that we would pick one that we either, that we like, or that we're into, or that we kind of see ascending. It's maybe another one typical, similar to the last one, where we will have slightly different approaches. But we thought we would talk about, pick a genre, and talk about it with some, you know, enthusiasm. Stephen Thompson.
All right. My genre is a genre of television in which Gary Busey has a traumatic brain injury for charity. Now, you know how I feel about Donald Trump. You know, pretzels are a $4 billion a year industry, and Auntie Anne's is a great company.
Yep. Oh, I missed that.
you know, this is the punchiest episode we've ever had. I don't know why.
You know how I feel about television programs in which rich people are treated as our benevolent daddies.
Yes. You love them.
I love them. They're my favorite, and I can't get enough of them.
Please see episode about Undercover Boss.
Undercover Boss and Secret Millionaire, both of which can be rolled up in a carpet and thrown off a bridge. But Celebrity Apprentice this season, and I'm on record like lambasting the show for being sort of low stakes and blah, blah, blah. The new season of Celebrity Apprentice is so massively, awesomely wackadoo and hilarious
That's great.
That I've completely turned around on it. And I think part of the reason, now there is no shortage of crazy on this show. You have your Star Jones, Dionne Warwick,
NeNe Leakes
faction
war going on.
Mm-hmm. On the other side of the Celebrity Apprentice docket is the men's team, which contains a faction that I would like to be given its own show and its own genre. And what I picture is week in and week out, Gary Busey, Meatloaf, Jose Canseco forming a kick line like on the street corner collecting money that at the end of each episode will be donated heartwarmingly to a charity. So, my genre of choice, Gary Busey and his traumatic brain injury, raise money for charity.
Oh. Is it possible that more context would make that funnier?
Well, no. It is true. We should say Gary Busey talks a lot about his brain injury, and that's the charity that he's raising
money for.
He is already people who it may seem like it's making fun of his injury, because it's part of his. It is literally part of his thing he does. He comes and talks about this injury. And
he talks openly about the fact that 23 years ago, he had a grisly motorcycle accident where he was not wearing a helmet, and he suffered a traumatic brain injury. And he's raising money on Celebrity Apprentice for the benefit of that.
For a charity.
So he sort of takes this injury on the road, as it were, and raises money for the people who cared for him when he was six.
It's not a matter of making light of traumatic brain injury.
The general silliness and the lengths to which people will go to get attention on that show, I think, is...
This season is really... I've hated that show for quite a while, too, but it is awesome.
I did notice in the middle of it, what was it, Monday night when it's on, there was just an eruption on my Twitter feed about somebody loud-talking Dionne Warwick and how little of that she was having.
don't mess with Dionne Warwick.
Dionne Warwick, it turns out, really feels that she's probably too good to be on Celebrity Apprentice, which I always have felt that there's a cure for that.
Yeah, right.
Just don't go on Celebrity Apprentice.
But to be fair, she really should have seen that coming. Psychic friends. There you go.
That never, ever, ever stops paying dividends, does it?
Anyway. Well, thank you, Stephen. I support your genre, and I enjoy it. Trey Graham.
As I imagine will be clear to anyone who has heard us talk about Downton Abbey or maybe even the Duchess of Duke Street, I am a gigantic fan of the costume drama. And as far as I'm concerned, the more repressed feelings there are muffled up under the corsets and the waistcoats, the better.
There you go.
So, for the purposes of this exercise, I wanted to say that I am particularly fond of Jane Austen-style situations wherein two people miscommunicate violently and with frosty decorum and are bound by some arcane system of etiquette or honor that makes it completely impossible for them to say the things that ought to be perfectly obvious and that would shortcut the plot by 220 pages.
Yeah. Right?
It's also Celebrity Apprentice, by the way.
I can see how that would be the case. It is always a genuine surprise to me when other people find these things slow or tedious or improbable. Because to paraphrase a line from, I think, Glenn Weldon, or at least in my perfect world, it's from Glenn Weldon, what my people do best is suffer resentfully and silently, not saying the things that would make an unbearable situation either better or worse, but would at least change the status quo.
Sounds like me.
So in such a situation, in my experience, you learn to read the subtext, or at least to imagine that you have a splendid talent for reading subtext, which can lead to either to surprising intuition or to gigantic misunderstandings, and both of those things can be highly entertaining. Mm-hmm. So I am naturally a fan of subtext both on stage and on the screen, and to me the perfect movie has about 8 lines of dialogue and 8,000 shots of Jennifer Ely looking woeful in the middle distance.
Perfect.
So that is my genre.
I love it.
It's your genre.
repressed costume drama in which almost nothing is said.
Yes.
Thank you, Trey Graham. I am on board 100%.
I would much rather watch Gary Busey in an open nightgown that has to be pixelated out performing a kick line on a New York street corner.
Yeah.
All right.
I'm going to side with Stephen on that one, actually.
All right, Glenn Weldon.
We've talked about this. We've touched on it before. It's fantasy novels with both maps and magic. We need both.
Can't have just the one.
Now, this is a genre that I got into in a big way, OD'd on when I was a kid, got chased out of it by some really terrible writing in my adolescence, and I'm only now starting to creep back into it. But it needs a map, because otherwise I feel like the author hasn't put in the work, you know?
Right.
Sure.
It needs magic, because otherwise it's like reading history. Why the hell would I do that?
Yeah.
So
you got to stop for the occasional spell.
Exactly. Yeah, you need something. So when I was a kid, I loved books like, of course, the Tolkien Lord of the Rings. And then I got off of Tolkien and switched to Terry Brooks' Sword of Shannara books, which, looking back now, are just Tolkien methadone. They are pale imitations and intensely derivative and some pretty bad writing. But I love things like Roger Zelazny's Chronicles of Amber, Robert Silverberg's Lord Valentine's Castle, which is technically science fiction and not fantasy, but it did the job. Ursula Le Guin's...
Those are different things.
Oh, the Earthsea books.
The Ursula Le Guin Wizard of Earthsea, Narnia, had magic, no map, at least not the editions I had, and it also seemed a little sanctimonious. So, that didn't... And there was also a series called Thomas Covenant, the Unbeliever, by Stephen R. Donaldson, which I loved, but I also thought that this guy really needs to lighten the hell up. These were some very angsty books. By the time I was 11, I found an author named Piers Anthony... Trey is having an episode.
There's a whole set of synapses firing in my head that haven't fired in a long, long time.
I'm saying, right? There's like 34 of these Xanth books now, and they're basically...
They're all puns.
They're just an endless stream of puns, and that sort of hits my sweet spot. I moved on from them to the Apprentice Adept series, which is
I was all excited for one second there.
Yeah, and then to
you're going in a different direction.
No, and the Incarnations of Immortality. All this is Piers Anthony, and... What struck me about him, reading him as a kid, was how much work he had done. He had put in the work. These are feats of imagination, the schematics of these books. This wizard is a red wizard, and he does this, and this is a blue wizard, and he only does this, and this is a black wizard, and he does this. Everything is so wrought and thought out. Connecting these very clever ideas is some of the worst, clunky, workmanlike prose and dialogue that a sixth grader, like me, would consider wooden. People in these novels turn to each other and say things like, as you know, on our planet, blah, blah, blah. People don't say that. And it's always, you know, I mean, you have to kind of deal with the names. So it's always like Blorflex the Squamous or whatever. That stuff I can take. But this writing was so bad that it chased me out of this entire genre for a long time. And it's only now that I'm finding people like George R.R. Martin, who does a series called The Song of Ice and Fire. The first book in that series is being made into a HBO?
Yep.
HBO.
Game of Thrones.
Game of Thrones is coming up pretty soon. Now, he dials back the magic to such a low simmer that it's almost not there, at least in the first book. And he's really much more interested in intrigue and in the psychology of characters. He's much better than Tolkien, for example, at creating characters who are rounded and you can kind of follow their motivations. And the writing is better. On a line-by-line level, you don't get chased out of it and wince. And also, there was a woman who just passed away last week, Diana Wynne Jones. She did this really great book called The Tough Guide to Fantasyland, which purports to be a guidebook to the fantasy genre or to this world, and it takes apart the fantasy tropes and cliches in a very, very funny way. So sad to miss her, but yeah, I'm getting back into it now.
Excellent.
So can I jump in with a couple of questions?
Sure.
Did you ever read the Raymond E. Feist books, Magician Apprentice, Magician Master, and the subsequent things?
Nope.
He's one of those guys who, at least in my recollection, it's been years since I've read them, but in my recollection, he built not just a world, but two linked worlds and mythologies connected to both, and then crossed them in some interesting ways. I'm curious to know if anybody in the audience has read them and what you think about where they measure up on that sort of scale that Glenn described.
I'm going to make an educated guess that several people in our audience have read them.
There's a guy named Stephen R. Bruce who wrote novels, a series of novels that center around a guy named Vlad Taltos. He's an assassin in a similarly complicated universe.
You should be using the nerd voice at this point.
I know. Sorry. It's a similarly complicated universe.
not bad.
I read those recently, and even as an adult, I found them rewarding.
Well, this
very
is
good.
What I want to hear from the people. Writing that doesn't suck. Is that too much to ask? Could I just have the fantasy and then the maps and the magic and everything with writing, line-by-line writing that just doesn't suck? Let me know. Recommend.
Dare I mention to you the name Anne McCaffrey?
Oh, yeah. Of course. I should have mentioned that. I read her in a big old way. Yeah.
Excellent. I get into a lot of discussions on Twitter about romance novels because I am hooked up to several women who love to talk about romance novels.
Really? I had no idea you were drawn that way.
And we have talked at times about looking for particular kinds, and I am actually sort of picky, which is why when I find an author, I tend to read all of it. And this is the problem with owning a Kindle, is that it's very easy. Well, it's the problem for your wallet. It's the great thing for the bookseller. And one of the reasons why genre fiction does so well on e-readers is that you can get the whole back catalog right away. Yep. You don't have to go to the bookstore. Usually a bookstore will have a couple of them, but not all of them. If you go to Amazon and if they're available for your Kindle, you can buy all of them. So you'll go through, and I wind up buying like 10 books by the same writer because they're pretty quick reads and whatever. So I go through pretty quickly, and what I find myself looking for is the romance novel of the non-dummy, right? Mm-hmm. Because it's very difficult in this kind of book to find women who are not stupid, because frequently frequently the only thing that the writer can think of to separate the couple until the end or the middle or whenever is for everyone to be stupid.
Right.
Often for the woman to be stupid. In a certain kind of book, for the woman to be stupid and the man to be terribly frustrated by her stupidity. And so I tend to seek out writers who can draw either both of the people to be complicated and, you know, conflicted for whatever reason. And I tend to seek out the love story of the non-stupid. And if you like the love story of the non-stupid, there's a writer, Jennifer Cruzy, who I like a lot, who wrote a book called Bet Me, which is the one that I recommend to everyone who says, I want to try a contemporary romance novel, kind of a legitimately genre type, not a fake piece of literary fiction
masquerading as
a romance novel, but a romance novel. There's also a writer named Kristen Higgins who writes ones that I like a lot. The women always tend to own large dogs, which I think is like large, friendly dogs. That's kind of a thing. I don't know exactly why. There's a woman named Julie.
Did not know that was a genre.
There's a woman named Julie James I like a lot. So when I find these writers, I tend to read everything. because it's so difficult to find and because the writers tend to be relatively consistent about it. But then once you wander off, then you're in the, I'm a hopeless, why do I just keep Bridget Jonesy kind of, you know. Not that I don't love Bridget Jones in its own way, but she's stupid. Anyway, so that's fine. The love story of the non-stupid. Great. And for all of you, if you have a genre that you love, especially a micro-genre, I love people who love micro-genres, let us know in the comments or on Facebook. And obviously your thoughts about our genres of choice.
And make recommendations.
And make lots of recommendations because we love that. And that brings us to the final segment in our show every week. What's making you happy this week? Stephen Thompson.
The New Jersey Turnpike.
You are easy to please.
I am.
Is it the Joyce Kilmer, or is it the... which rest stop is it?
Kilmer. This past weekend, I took my beloved children up to visit my sister and her husband and their son for his 8th birthday party. This was a nerd party, you'll be happy to note. Mm-hmm. The door prizes in the little party bag included Doctor Who mugs, where when you fill them with a hot liquid, the TARDIS disappears from one side and reappears on the other side.
Rock on.
Pretty sweet.
So,
pretty cool.
If you could see the look of lust in Gordon's eyes right now.
He's making a note about Googling that.
So this was a nerd kind of party. All of my closest non-estranged nerd relatives were all in one place. But anyway, driving down the New Jersey Turnpike at sunset, I was overwhelmed with what can only be described as kind of a cultural experience of seeing all these milestones that have been addressed in some of my favorite albums of all time, which include primary among them the album Your Favorite Music by Clem Snide, which the cover photograph was actually shot at the Vince Lombardi Service Plaza, where the band is lined up wearing powder blue suits, standing in a marsh. I stopped just short of doing an Abbey Road style recreation of that cover with my kids.
With your children, making them stand in a marsh. Children,
making them stand in a marsh in March. But also, the first three albums by the band Fountains of Wayne very, very aggressively address all of these. I mean, Fountains of Wayne itself is a New Jersey landmark. Plus the Vince Lombardi, you know, element being a Packer fan, it all felt very much like a strange homecoming, even though I had never been on the New Jersey Turnpike in my life. And so the cultural tie-in of those wonderful records makes it the thing that is making me happy this week.
That's awesome. Great.
You might have recognized some Sopranos, something from the Sopranos opening credits as you drove there, too.
Mm-hmm. I suppose the Sopranos, whatever. I happen to pick nerdy rock.
Gotcha.
That's great. That is great. Trey Graham, what's making you happy this week?
Potentially shippable product increments. No, really, this is
just so sexy. I'm fanning myself over here.
It's like the petite lap giraffe.
Exactly, that and the petite lap giraffe. Potentially shippable product increments is a term of art in something called agile software development, and I just started a new project as the editorial lead on an agile team, which is something I've never done before, and with any luck, it will pay off in a few months with some things that we can talk about here and share with listeners. But what's important about it to me this week is that for the first time in several years, actually, I am doing something that absolutely terrifies me in a stretching, pushing, learning new things kind of way. And it is incredibly obvious when you say it out loud, but I'd almost forgotten how good that feels. So potentially shippable product increments.
I don't understand a single word you just said, especially the part about enjoying learning new things.
Oh, boy. Glenn Weldon, what's making you happy this week?
Albert Brooks is on Twitter.
Oh my God.
Albert Brooks came on Twitter.
I was pretty sure you were going to pick that.
Albert Brooks came on Twitter on Sunday, and he's doing it only to promote a book. He's very upfront about that. He's got a book coming out, and his publisher is forcing him. Albert Brooks is one of the greats. He's a comedian. He's a filmmaker. His early 1970s album called Comedy Minus One is a seminal text. And his films, his first real life, which besides being very, very funny, also presages all of what reality television is. Modern Romance, probably my favorite of his films. Mm-hmm. The next one, a case could be made that it invented cringe comedy. I'm not going to make that case, but someone could. Mm-hmm. Lost in America, the one I've seen more often than any others. So funny, so good, about a couple who quit their jobs and just take a Winnebago across America. Defending Your Life has its moments. Mother, the muse. And anyway, he's also known for his Simpsons cameos, the
Absolutely.
Best Simpsons cameos ever.
Yes.
So he started on Sunday. We're taping this on Tuesday, and when I checked, he had about 25,000 followers, which is, in a sense, heartening. Mm-hmm. Way to go, America. Good. When he has 25,000 and some fatuous social marketing branding guru has more, when a Kardashian has more than Albert Brooks, something has gone wrong. So get on this, people. And he gets it. This is the important thing. He gets it. Here's a recent tweet. Had fun talking to everyone yesterday. Best time since I used to go on the original AOL chat rooms as Barbra Streisand. Now, here's how you can tell he gets it. The hashtag that comes right after is hashtag Middle East. He gets it. He's a good guy. So follow him, Albert Brooks. You'll be glad you did.
That's great. Yeah, I was pretty sure you're going to pick
it. Yeah.
I have two things this week. The super quick thing that I will mention is that last Thursday's episode of The Office, for people who have fallen away from watching The Office, was a wonderfully heartening return to many of the things that I have loved about that show. It was funny, but it was also incredibly sweet. And if you have wandered away from it because it sort of lost some of its mojo, which I think you can argue it did, seriously, go back for these last couple of Steve Carell episodes and sort of warm yourself up, and you can watch them and you'll get what's going on. It was a great episode. They still know what they're doing. They wander around sometimes and they have trouble balancing elements, but they still know how to make a great, great episode. And I just want to say, last Thursday, by the time you see this, it'll be a week ago. It's an episode called Garage Sale. And seek it out. It's on Hulu. Watch it. It's really, really wonderful, and I congratulate them. The other thing that is making me happy this week is a series that is just starting that I will be able to show you more of by the time we are making the show available, but it is starting right now. And Dave Holmes, who is one of my favorite people on Twitter, he's a comedian. You may know him from his unsuccessful attempt to win the I Want to Be an MTV VJ contest.
Is that still what
many
people know
years
him
ago?
For?
You'd be surprised how often people I throw it in there because A, it's funny because he lost to Jesse Camp, who is now no one.
Yep.
And Dave Holmes is now a genius. So it's one of those funny stories. But primarily, he's a comedian. I saw his live show one time. He was with Rob Delaney and Patton Oswalt, a bunch of other people. And he is just starting a web show called A Drink with Dave that is going to have comedians and musicians and everybody. It's a web video show where they're going to sit down and just have chats. And he knows all these really interesting comics, and he's kind of in this great pod of comedy people on Twitter who know each other, and I'm super excited about it. And that what is making me happy this week is just the promise of something like this actually existing for me to watch every day, because I'm a big fan and I'm super excited. So A Drink with Dave, it's at adrinkwithdave.com, and we will we'll link to it and show you some where you can find some episodes. So that's what's making me happy this week.
Nice.
Awesome. Dave Holmes, no relation, as I always call him.
So, that is his name, Dave Holmes, no relation.
Dave Holmes, no relation. That brings us to the end of Pop Culture Happy Hour for another week. And you can follow all of us on Twitter. You can follow me and the blog at NPR Monkey C. You can follow Glenn at G.H. Weldon. That's W-E-L-D-O-N. You can follow Trey at Trey Graham. That is Trey with an E. And Graham like the cracker. You can follow Stephen at I Dislike Stephen. That's S-T-E-P-H-E-N. You can follow our esteemed producer Mike Katziff at Mike Katziff. That's K-A-T-Z-I-F. Mike's band Hello Come In provides our in and out music, which you are tapping your foot to right now. And I also want to throw in one last plug, which is that if you search for the hashtag NPR Dishes, you can find you can find the game that I was playing last Friday with everyone throwing in their food dishes based on the names of NPR personalities.
Such as Calamari Shapiro.
Calamari Shapiro and Filet Montaigne. So if you do a little search, feel free. It's kind of waned, but there's still time to enter your excellent.
It can be revived.
Your excellent NPR dish.
I like the newest NPR music member, Flan K. Powers, made an appearance.
It was great. It was great. Also, all things corn salad. That was my
other. That's good.
So you can find all of us on Twitter. You can find us on Facebook by searching for Pop Culture Happy Hour. Thanks to all of you for being here.
Thank you.
Miss it.
And that's this week, and we will see all of you next week.